Well, thank you, Mr. Troyer. Brethren, the God you worship is God of gods and Lord of lords. Turn with me, if you would, to Exodus chapter 12, and we'll read verses 11 and 12. Here we are in the spring holy day season, when the middle of the days of unleavened bread nearing its end. And one of the things we look back upon is the miraculous release of God's people from captivity in Egypt. And as God was going to release His people through the 10 plagues, God made a statement here in Exodus chapter 12 that as well as releasing the Israelites from captivity, He, in one sense, we might say, was going to make a statement. He was going to make a point through all of this as well. Here in Exodus 12, in verse 11, He talks about the Passover. You shall thus eat it with a belt on your waist, your sandals on your feet, and your staff in your hand. So shall you eat it in haste. It is the Lord's Passover. So eat it, being ready to travel, because in a very few short hours you would go out, spoil the Egyptians, and by the next evening take off into an entirely new life. Then He says in verse 12, "For I will pass through the land of Egypt on that night, and will strike all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, both man and beast." And then He says something else, "And against all the gods of Egypt, I will execute judgment." Why? He says, "I am the Eternal. I am the Lord." It was on this day that God was going to show His people that they had no reason to revere the gods of the Egyptians, because they were really not gods at all. They had no power to save. They have no power to rescue, no power to protect, no power to bless. Only the true God can do those things. And as Israel came out of Egypt, God and God alone was to be seen as the sole source of blessing and protection and power and salvation. So who were these gods of Egypt? And what were they supposed to be doing? What were they supposed to protect or to bless? How did God humiliate the gods of the Egyptians? We'll come to see that the plagues systematically shattered the perceived power and dominance of the Egyptian gods. So this afternoon, as we near the completion of these days of unleavened bread, we're going to look at the gods of Egypt and show how the true God conquered them all and showed Himself to be the only true God. Let's take a look at the plagues beginning back in Exodus chapter 7. It is through these plagues that God not only would set the stage for rescuing His people, but He would directly assault and insult the gods of the Egyptians. Now, as we turn to Exodus chapter 7 for the first plague, it is important to remind ourselves that the Egyptian society was a massive and great society, we might say, for a couple thousand years. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. So when you begin to study Egyptian religion, you'll find it an absolute mass of confusion that evolves and develops over time. And gods that were popular in one part of Egypt were not necessarily as popular in other parts of Egypt. And gods that had one name in Lower Egypt had a different name in Upper Egypt. And then over the course of time, these gods and goddesses blend together. And their roles change over the course of time. So we obviously cannot in any way give the complete story of the gods of Egypt. But I believe we can touch on enough during the period of time in which Israel would have been alive in Egypt, that will give us a very good picture of the gods of the Egyptians and what our God did to them. In Exodus chapter 7, beginning in verse 14, the Lord said to Moses, Pharaoh's heart is hard. He refuses to let the people go. As we know, Pharaoh is a type of Satan the devil, who likewise would like to keep us in spiritual blindness and spiritual captivity. Go to Pharaoh in the morning when he goes out to the water. You shall stand by the river's bank to meet him. And the rod which was turned into a serpent you shall take in your hand. Apparently, according to most historians, each morning the royalty of Egypt would go out to the Nile River with the priests, and they would perform this little ritual, the water ritual, each day, because they recognized that they lived in the middle of the desert. And without water, specifically the water from the Nile itself, they would not be able to survive. There was nothing but sand for miles and miles and miles. Without the Nile Delta, without the floods from the Nile basically pouring silt all over this area, without that, no crops really would grow whatsoever. So they depended upon the Nile for their life. So every day the Pharaohs would go out. As you know, when Moses was plucked out of the water, Pharaoh's daughter was probably there doing this same kind of service. Verse 16, you shall say to him, the eternal God of the Hebrews has sent me to you, saying, let my people go that they may serve me in the wilderness. You today are serving God in the wilderness. Out of all the 350 million Americans, you represent a small, smaller than small, drop in the bucket. You live in a spiritual wilderness of complete confusion, not unlike the religious confusion of Egypt. God likewise expects you to serve him in the wilderness. But indeed, he says, until now you would not hear. Thus says the Eternal, verse 17, by this you shall know that I am the Eternal. I will strike the waters which are in the river with the rod that is in my hand, and they shall be turned to blood. And the fish that are in the river shall die, the river shall stink, and the Egyptians will loathe to drink the water of the river. Clearly they won't be able to. Then the Eternal spoke to Moses, say to Aaron, take your rod, stretch out your hand over the waters of Egypt, over their streams, over their rivers, over their ponds, over all their pools of water, that they may become blood. And there shall be blood throughout all the land of Egypt, both in the buckets of wood and pitchers of stone. Now, contrary to Cecil B. DeMille, it was not Charlton Heston who raised his rod and stuck it in the Nile. Aaron was instructed to do this by Moses. And Moses and Aaron did, verse 20, just as the Eternal commanded. So he lifted up the rod and struck the waters that were in the river in the sight of Pharaoh and in the sight of his servants, probably when he again went out to do this water ceremony. And all the waters that were in the river turned to blood. And the fish that were in the river died. The river stank, and the Egyptians could not drink the water of the river. So there was blood throughout all the land of Egypt. Now you know that that is physically impossible. But with God, all things are possible. And it's not difficult for God to change the chemical composition of something like this to blood. It was easy for him. He's the creator of the universe. And of course, he was emphasizing that. So what we have here is a strike against the waters of Egypt. Now, an interesting thing, if you've ever watched that movie, The Ten Commandments, every once in a while, you see Pharaoh praying to his gods. At least at the very end, when his son dies, you see him bowing before a god and asking for his son's life back. Who would they have been praying to in this regard? Well, there are several gods that should have been on duty protecting the Nile. Several, actually. The first one's name is Khnum. It's spelled, if you bring it into English, at least one of the translations, K-H-N-U-M, Khnum. Num was one of the most ancient gods of Egypt, whose worship is thought to have been popular early in Egyptian history and continuing on from there. Num was originally a water god who was thought to rule over all water everywhere, the rivers, the lakes, even the river of the underworld. He was supposed to be taking care of all of that. And here he is shown to be inept. He'd been conquered by Yahweh, the true God. Num was associated with the source of the Nile, and he was to ensure that the yearly flood deposited enough precious black silt onto the riverbanks and in this delta area to make them fertile. The silt also formed clay, the raw material required to make all pottery. So as a result, this god is also associated with the art of pottery making. Now, according to one creation myth of the Egyptians, Num mounded or molded everything on his potter's wheel, including both people and other gods, and as they flung off the end of the potter's wheel, they landed on the earth and began to populate the earth. So he was one of the chief gods in early Egypt, but he was inept before the true God. There's a second Egyptian god that should have been on duty. His name, ironically enough, was Hapi. Now, you would think that'd be the frog god or the happy god, but H-A-P-I, Hapi. Hapi was the god of the annual flood of the Nile in the ancient Egyptian religion. The flood, as you know, deposited this rich silt, this fertile soil, on the riverbanks, which allowed the Egyptians to grow the massive wheat, for example, that they were able to do and the other crops that they would grow. So as a water and fertility god, he was popular throughout ancient Egypt. Hapi was the patron of both Upper and Lower Egypt, and this role, together with his connection with the Nile and the annual flood, made him one of the most popular and powerful of all the ancient deities of Egypt. I love this one quote. Since the flooding provided fertile soil in an area that was otherwise desert, Hapi, as its patron, symbolized fertility. He was said to bring a rich and nourishing harvest. Due to his fertile nature, he was sometimes considered the father of the gods. In other words, the god over the Nile was considered sometimes father over all the other gods. And he was considered to be a caring father who helped to maintain the balance of the cosmos, the world, or universe, regarded as an orderly, harmonious system. You see, the Egyptians could depend every year on this clear cyclical flood that would bring fertile soil so they could grow their crops and they go through the cycle. So when this flood came of blood, all of a sudden the entire cosmos is upset. And one of the most powerful gods of Egypt, again, is shown to be inept before the true God. So this would have been a tremendous emotional impact upon the Egyptians. God strikes first at the very core of their religious beliefs. Hapi was thought to live within a cavern at the supposed source of the Nile near Aswan. You've probably heard of Aswan from the famous dam that was built by the Russians there a number of decades ago. The inundation of the flood was referred to as the arrival of Hapi. In other words, he would, in their minds, leave his cave, turn the water on, send it downstream so that it would flood everywhere and produce this wonderfully fertile soil. During the flood, the Egyptians would place statues of this god in the towns and cities so that they could implore his assistance in the spring floods. God struck at the very heart of the Egyptian religion from the very beginning. Let's go on to plague number two. Now, we will pause at this point to mention also that it is very clear that we could list a half a dozen other gods under each of these things, because when we talk about polytheism, the number of gods in ancient Egypt is difficult to number. Some of the most talked about can be listed, but we're talking about probably 30, 40, maybe 50 separate gods. So we could easily list many under each of these areas, but we'll just talk about maybe the main characters. Here in chapter 8, beginning in verse 1, the Lord spoke to Moses, "Go to Pharaoh and say to him, 'Thus says the Eternal, let my people go that they may serve me.' But if you refuse to let them go, behold, I will smite all your territory with frogs." Now, for the uninitiated, that might not seem like much. Oh, you're going to send a frog after me. Wow, I'm scared. But when there are millions of frogs, now we're talking about something that's a bit odd, to say the least. "I will smite your territory with frogs." Verse 3, "So the river shall bring forth frogs abundantly, which shall go up and come into your house." Now, it's interesting that the Egyptian symbol for 100,000 is, guess what? A tadpole. Because they honestly thought frogs were a wonderful thing, and they are. But when you have millions and millions more than you need, it's not a very nice thing at all. The river shall bring forth frogs abundantly, which shall go up and come into your house, into your bedroom, on your bed, into the houses of your servants, and on your people, into your ovens, and into your kneading bowls. There'll be so many, it will be a swarm, we might say. And frogs shall come up on you, on your people, and all your servants. Then the Lord said, the Eternal said to Moses, "Say to Aaron, 'Stretch out your hand with your rod over the streams, over the rivers, over the ponds, and cause frogs to come up on the land of Egypt.' So Aaron stretched out his hand over the waters of Egypt, and the frogs came up and covered the land of Egypt." Now, thankfully, the magicians of Pharaoh were able to bring up more frogs. How helpful is that? We've already got enough, thank you. But again, it was, this is just some sort of trick, like the blood in the water previously. Which gods should have been on duty to prevent this terrible plague? Well, one of the goddesses of Egypt was a woman called Hekate, H-E-Q-E-T, Hekate, sometimes called Hekat. She was a goddess of childbirth and fertility in ancient Egypt. And as goddess of fertility, you see, if we had a goddess of fertility in America, she would be a woman's body with a rabbit head. But because there were so many frogs around the Nile, this goddess had a woman's body and depicted as a frog head, or sometimes as a frog entirely, her whole body. Frogs symbolized fruitfulness, new life, prosperity, lots of reproduction. So she was the one who was supposed to be watching over this. She was embarrassed by this plague. Frogs symbolized this newness of life. In fact, it is thought that her priestesses were actually the midwives in ancient Egypt. So they were supposed to be, all of a sudden, these frogs just start multiplying like crazy. Now, each year after the spring flood, there were more frogs than normal. So again, we're talking nearing the spring of the year here. This would have been a time for frogs to start multiplying. But multiplying in this number was absolutely unheard of. The frog was an ancient symbol to the Egyptians of fertility. It was related to the annual flooding of the Nile. And as legend has it, Hekate is the wife and consort of other gods. And so she is the southern god of creation in one sense. Again, when Khum did his potter's wheel and these life forms start flying off the potter's wheel onto the earth, she was there, the frog goddess, breathing life into these new creations that came off the potter's wheel. Again, it gets pretty strange. But nonetheless, she also was thought of as breathing life into new babies and then placing them into the wombs of the mothers who would have those babies. So amulets of Heket were worn by women to protect them while they gave birth. So here's this goddess who's supposed to be producing life and prosperity and fertility, and all of a sudden she's completely overrun by this plague of frogs. Verse 8, Pharaoh called for Moses and Aaron and said in chapter 8, verse 8, "Entreat the Eternal that he may take away the frogs from me and from my people. I will let the people go that they may sacrifice to the Eternal." Of course, he was either lying or, once the pressure was off, he recanted. Moses said to Pharaoh, "Accept the honor of saying when I shall intercede for you, for your servants, and for your people, to destroy the frogs from you and your houses, that they may remain in the river only." So he said, "Tomorrow." And he said, "Let it be according to your word, that you may know that there is one God, no one like the Eternal, our God. All the frogs shall depart from you, from your houses, from your servants, from your people. They shall remain in the river only where they belong." Moses and Aaron went out from Pharaoh. Moses cried to the Eternal concerning the frogs which he had brought against Pharaoh. So the Eternal did according to the word of Moses, and the frogs died out of the houses, out of the courtyards, and out of the fields. Well, that's not quite what I meant. I wanted to be rid of the frogs, but not just dead frogs. Now, if you grew up in the country, you probably drive along country roads sometimes, and what do you see along the roads near the swamp areas? This frog mash. Where people, frogs end up on the road and you just run them over and there's just little mashed frogs everywhere. This is much worse than that. They just all died. They gathered them together, verse 14, in heaps, and the land stank. No wonder. But when Pharaoh saw that there was relief, he hardened his heart, did not heed them, as the Eternal had said. Let's go on to plague number 3 and the gods that God addressed at this point. In verse 16, we have the plague that's sometimes referred to as lice. So the Eternal said to Moses, "Say to Aaron, stretch out your rod and strike the dust of the land so that it may become lice throughout all the land of Egypt." Again, this dust, this dirt, this soil was supposed to be Egypt's food, because the silt would be brought down by the river, crops were planted in it. It was the sustenance of life. It will become lice throughout the land of Egypt. And they did so. For Aaron stretched out his hand, verse 17, with his rod and struck the dust of the earth, and it became lice on man and beast. All the dust of the land became lice throughout all the land of Egypt. Now you pause there for a moment. The Hebrew word translated here into the English lice is the word ken, K-E-N. And in our English language, we tend to use the word lice. Now, if you've ever had or seen something like head lice, it just is kind of a creepy thing. Now, it may have very well been lice. At the same time, in our English translation, we could also say things like sand flies or fleas might have been what was actually the plague. Sand fleas or sand flies, in some marginal notes, are the way this word is translated as lice. The Hebrew word ken comes from a root meaning to dig. So it's probable that the insect was one which digs under the skin of people. So others translate this swarms of gnats. Moffat actually translates this word as mosquitoes. Now, I've been a few times in my life in swarms of mosquitoes. This is not sitting out in the backyard barbecue and you get bit a couple times in an evening. I remember one time in the backwoods of Minnesota, being in a spot at sunset that literally came alive with mosquitoes. And I mean swarms of mosquitoes. And you start getting bit multiple times all at once, and it is enough to drive you crazy. How many have seen the famous, what was his name, the movie African Queen? Remember that movie? Okay, everybody with really, really lots of years of experience, remember that movie. They're going down the Nile River, and these swarms of insects come upon them, and it's so devastating. The only thing they can do is cover themselves up with this thick, thick canvas tarp to get these insects away from them. Another time I was hunting, turkey hunting actually, in what was in essence a swamp. And literally to be able to hear the mosquitoes buzzing off, like, that cannot be. There cannot be so many mosquitoes that it just will drive you absolutely batty, because there's nothing you can do. The swarm is so thick and they're all so hungry. So these lice, these fleas, these flies, whatever they were, swarms of them apparently, just were devastating to the Egyptians. Can you imagine being bit all these times? Just a little flea bite. When our children were very small, we moved to Houston. And the home we moved into, unbeknownst to us, had a few pets before we moved in. And those pets left behind all their fleas. Because we'd pray in the morning, and, man, my shins are all itchy. I don't know why they itch like that. We look on our daughter's legs, and there's all these little bumps and little bleeding spots. Like, what is that? We'd never experienced that before. Well, the dogs had left behind fleas. And so, since the hosts that the fleas were used to feeding on were now gone, we were the new hosts. And so you got to clear it out, fog every place, spray everything. I had to spray the walls. I don't know if you ever had these flea problems. I have to spray the walls up to about 2 feet high, because the fleas will actually lay eggs on the wall. So you can spray the carpet, but they'll hatch on the wall and come and bite you. It's terrible. Terrible things. Can you imagine this all over your body, all the time, all at once? You can't do anything about it. This would be unbearable. Well, what gods should have been on duty taking care of the Egyptians so that this didn't happen to them? Some scholars feel that the god most at fault was Geb. Sometimes Geb is G-E-B, sometimes it's S-E-B, Seb. Geb is one of the most important Egyptian gods in ancient history about the time that Israel would have been there. Geb was the god of the earth. Sometimes he's portrayed as laying on his back, basically as the earth with the sky up arching over the top of him. He was the god of the earth. His consort, his wife, and also sister, strangely enough, was the sky goddess, Nut, N-U-T, or Nut, as they apparently pronounce it. His skin in reliefs is generally green, the color of living things. And it represents the vegetation that grows on the earth. The sign used in his name became associated with vegetation, the lush farmland by the Nile. It was said that barley grew out of his ribs, and he was depicted with green patches of vegetation all over his body. Egyptians gave offerings to Geb for the bounty of the soil, and yet it's from this soil that this plague springs. The dust that was supposed to provide them food and comfort now provided them nothing but biting insects. So God strikes another of the Egyptian pantheon down, shows him to be incompetent in this circumstance. Let's go on to plague number four. Exodus chapter 8, in verse 20. The Eternal said to Moses, "Rise early in the morning and stand before Pharaoh as he comes out to the water," that daily ritual that Pharaoh would have gone through. "Then say to him, thus says the Eternal, let my people go that they may serve me. Or else, if you will not let my people go, I will send swarms on you." There's the word of flies is not in the Hebrew. It simply says swarms. "I will send swarms on you and your servants, on your people and into your houses. The houses of the Egyptians shall be full of swarms, and also the ground on which they stand. In that day I will set apart the land of Goshen in which my people dwell, that no swarm shall be there, in order that you may know that I am the Eternal in the midst of this land. I will make a difference between my people and your people. Tomorrow this sign shall be. And what happened? Verse 24. And the Lord did so. Thick swarms came into the house of Pharaoh. I don't know about you, but thick swarms of anything sounds miserable. Would you like a thick swarm? Well, no, really, I'd rather pass on that, thank you. And into all the land of Egypt, the land was corrupted because of the swarms. So what were these flies? Again, the Hebrew simply says swarms. Jameson Fawcett Brown has an interesting comment about these swarms. JFB says, included in the swarms, and he feels, as many commentators do, that there were multiple kinds of insects in these swarms. He feels it included the gadfly, which is a biting fly. In Minnesota, we know them as the no-see-ums, these tiny little insects that you can hardly see, but that bite like crazy. Anybody ever had no-see-ums attack you? They are miserable things. They are just... Anyway, he says, gadflies, cockroaches, and Egyptian beetles. Because Psalm 78, verse 45 says, diverse sorts of flies, when it refers to this plague. So not just one kind of fly, but different kinds of flies. What gods should have been protecting the Egyptians during this plague? Probably the primary one is Uatchit. I'll spell that for you. U-A-T-C-H-I-T. Uatchit. Now, as we know, the text here does not say flies. It uses the Hebrew word for swarms. So the idea of flies, the reason it comes into the King James is because when the Greeks translated the Septuagint version, the Hebrew into Greek, they rendered it flies. But they were thinking of the dog fly, which again is this gadfly, this biting fly. It's called a dog fly because it bites like a dog. It just hurts when they bite. So that may have been the case. That may carry some weight in regard to the translation. Because many of the translators, by the way, of the Septuagint lived in Egypt, northern parts of Egypt. So that may have been the case. They may have known what they were talking about. Nonetheless, the blood-sucking dogfly or gadfly was a great bother to the Egyptian. And some feel it was responsible for blindness. Now, maybe that was the case, maybe not. Maybe that was just an ancient wives' tale. But nonetheless, they may have carried some kind of bacteria or problem that could have caused those things, possibly. It might also be a different kind of fly, which actually deposits its larva on living things, and it begins to eat living things. So, the Egyptians were frightened. Their god, Uatchit, should not have let this happen. The plague showed that she was incapable. I jotted down this. I thought it would be copied this. Thought it would be helpful. This plague was a judgment on Uatchit because the goddess, she was the god of Upper Egypt. The fly is regarded as a symbol, her symbol. The effect of this plague was oppressive and grievous. The fly in Egyptian mythology gave protection against disease or misfortune. Uatchit was not just protector of Egypt, but an aggressive defender of king himself. Her hood is spread in a threatening position, and she's ready to spit poison on all of Pharaoh's enemies or burn them with her fiery glare. She was a personification of the sun's burning heat. This Egyptian deity, usually associated with flies, is this goddess. She's called the Lady of the Marshes, where papyrus grows and many insects are known to originate. She's known as the goddess of flame and noonday heat. She guards all life in the Nile Delta. The goddess Uatchet is depicted with wings, and she wears a cobra symbol on her head, just as the pharaohs did. So again, she was supposed to be guarding life in the Nile Delta, and she wasn't able to control this at all. Now, a second god that would have been implicated in this plague was Amon-Ra himself. Because there are scholars who don't accept the fly explanation of this section of Scripture, and they rather think that the swarm was the scarab beetle, swarms of scarabs. Now, we're all familiar from movies like The Mummy about this scarab beetle. It's this small, I mean, in real life, they're only about an inch long or inch wide, inch round. But they have these mandibles, these jaws that are all jagged on the end, and they can chew through wood. And many of them are worse than termites by far. So many scholars feel that that may be what's being described. I'll read this. Many think the passage implies the scarab beetle, which actually is a dung beetle. Swarms of scarabs with mandibles that can saw through wood were destructive and worse than termites. Deification of the scarab was found in the creator and king god Amun-Ra. The deification of the scarab beetle is still conspicuous even today in jewelry and artifacts celebrating ancient Egypt. Amun-Ra, the king of the gods, had the head of a beetle. Gives new meaning to Beetlejuice or Beetle Bailey, I guess. Ra, the sole creator, was visible to the people of Egypt as a disk of the sun, but they knew him in many other forms. He could appear as a crowned man, a falcon, or man with a falcon's head, and as the scarab beetle pushes a round ball of dung in front of it, the Egyptian pictured Ra as a scarab pushing the sun across the sky. So again, here was this creator of all life that was supposed to be able to control these things, and he had no ability to protect the Egyptians from these swarms. Let's look at plague number 5, Exodus chapter 9 and verse 1. Then the Eternal said to Moses, "Go to Pharaoh, tell him, thus says the Eternal God of the Hebrews, let my people go, that they may serve me. For if you refuse to let them go and still hold them, behold, the hand of the Eternal will be on your cattle in the field, on the horses, on the donkeys, on the camels, and on the oxen, on the sheep, a very severe pestilence." When it uses the word cattle, it better is translated livestock. Livestock. "And the Eternal will make a difference between the livestock of Israel and the livestock of Egypt, so that nothing shall die of all that belongs to the children of Israel. The Lord appointed a set time, saying, 'Tomorrow the Lord will do this thing in the land.' So the Lord did this thing on the next day, and all the livestock of Egypt died. But of the livestock of the children of Israel, not one died." Now, when it says all the livestock, it doesn't mean every single animal, but obviously the vast majority. "Pharaoh sent, and indeed not even one of the livestock of the Israelites was dead. But the heart of Pharaoh became hard, and he did not let the people go." What god should have been taking care of the Egyptian livestock? Now, the Egyptians worshipped and deified almost all animals, so this plague would have been an attack against many gods, but we'll list a few of them. The first one is Ptah, spelled P-T-A-H. Ptah is often described as an abstract form of the self-created one who made the universe either by the wish of his heart and by his tongue. Now, it's interesting that Ptah had several aspects. One was the bull or cattle. The Apis bull was regarded as the Ba, one of the parts of the soul of the god himself. Large numbers of bulls and cows were considered sacred. Many areas in Egypt chose them as their emblems. A temple was discovered in Memphis that contained the Apis bull, which was considered the sacred animal of the god Ptah. What they would do is they would choose this bull. We'll talk a little bit more about this later. They would choose a bull, and that would become the god himself. And they'd bring this god into their temple. They would feed it alfalfa. They got him a harem of other cows because he was the god. And he'd live there until he died. And then they would mummify him. There were tombs found with 40 of these Apis bulls actually mummified with the pharaoh. So talk about a lot of bull, right? Literally true in this case. There's a second Egyptian god, Hathor. H-A-T-H-O-R. H-A-T-H-O-R. Hathor. Hathor was one of the most popular goddesses in all Egypt, and she enjoyed a significant cult following throughout history. Through this, she also evolved into several goddesses with distinguishing functions and associations. She's often depicted as either a woman with the head of a cow or a woman with two curled cow's horns that hold between them a solar disk. So talk about a cow. She was literally a cow in this case. She was also referred to as the goddess of love and beauty, represented by this cow, often depicted as a cow suckling the pharaohs and giving the pharaoh divine nourishment of the gods. Now, because of her popularity, she's associated with several other goddesses in function and feature. She can be a sun goddess, a sky goddess, a moon goddess, goddess of the west, of the east, goddess of fertility, goddess of moisture, goddess of fertility, goddess of agriculture, even a goddess of the underworld. So she acquired a number of different titles. But strictly speaking, Hathor is the goddess of beauty, music, dance, joy, motherhood, and love. She was considered a protective goddess of the women, especially pregnant ones, thus linking her to the mother of Pharaoh. So here is Hathor, cow goddess, and yet it's all the cows that die. You would think the cow goddess would take care of the livestock of Egypt, but she did not. There's another god, Nevis, spelled M-N-E-V-I-S. Nevis was the sacred bull. And again, this was literally the Apis bull that would be chosen to be God incarnate. Protector of all livestock, and yet completely inept in this responsibility. Another god that would have been implicated at this time was Amon himself. Amon, later known as Amon-Ra, had a festival once a year in ancient Egypt called the Opet Festival. And a statue of Amun would transverse the route of the Nile from Luxor to Karnak in celebration of his marriage. And his nickname was the Bull of his Mother. He should have been on duty caring for the Egyptians. Let's go on to number six. The sixth plague of boils. Exodus chapter 9 and verse 8. So the Eternal said to Moses and Aaron, take for yourselves handfuls of ashes from a furnace and let Moses scatter it toward the heavens in the sight of Pharaoh. These probably would have been ashes from the brick kilns that the Israelites were forced maybe into making bricks. Many of them probably were sun-dried, but the strength of some bricks in Egypt showed they must have been kiln-dried as well. Nonetheless, throw this dust up into the sky, verse 9, and it will become fine dust in all the land of Egypt. And it will cause boils that break out in sores on man and beast throughout all the land of Egypt. So this terrible skin disease breaks out. They took ashes from the furnace, stood before Pharaoh, and Moses scattered them toward heaven. And they caused boils that break out in sores on man and beast, some kind of skin disease. And the magicians could not stand before Moses because of the boils. For the boils were on the magicians and all the Egyptians. So this terrible skin disease. Who fell down in Egyptians' pantheon at this point? Two gods that we'll touch on. There could be others as well. Sekhmet, S-E-K-H. M-E-T, Sekhmet. Sekhmet is the Egyptian goddess of sun, war, destruction, plagues, and healing. She's one of the oldest and most powerful of the Egyptian deities. Her name is derived from the Egyptian word Sekhem, which means power or might. So it's often translated that she is the powerful one or she who is powerful. She's depicted as a lion-headed woman, sometimes with the addition of the sun disk on her head. Sekhmet was represented by the searing heat of midday sun. She could avert plague and cure disease for her friends. She was the patron of physicians and healers, and her priests became known as skilled doctors. Just as we said, Heket, her priestesses were midwives. In this case, Sekhmet's priests were doctors. As a result, the fearsome deity, sometimes called the Lady of Terror, was also known as Lady of Life. Sekhmet should have kept the Egyptians safe from this plague, but was unable to do so. Then there's the name of a god that you're probably familiar with, again from Hollywood movies, Imhotep. Imhotep. Imhotep was the only Egyptian, besides Amenhotep, to be fully deified. He was a man, and later, kind of like the Catholics make somebody a saint after they die, well, in this case, Imhotep became a god after his death. Now, he lived several, probably a century, or maybe even as much as a millennia, I should say, before the Israelites came onto the scene in Egypt. We're talking about 2200 BC, long time before that. So by the time the Israelites would have been in Egypt, he would have already been a god, deified by the Egyptians. But he was the god of wisdom and medicine. According to some sources, god of science, medicine, and agriculture. Imhotep was a priest. He was a vizier to one of the early kings in Egypt. Back in the third dynasty, he was a poet, a mathematician, an astronomer, an architect. He built some of the first of the pyramids, the step pyramids. An amazing talent, no doubt. But he's remembered for his medical treatises, which regarded disease and injury as naturally occurring. So he began to be a healer. He was inept, again, before the great God of the universe, to prevent any of this disease, these boils, to break out on the skin of the Egyptians and the Egyptian priests. So God, again, strikes out at the gods of Egypt. Now, you might think as we go through these, we're coming up to number 7, are there modern gods that our people worship? Are there modern gods similar? Oh, we think, oh, we are far too educated to believe these silly myths of the Egyptians. But ask yourself as you go along, do we worship? And are we dependent upon, and do we receive our sustenance from, the modern version of these gods? We'll draw more attention to that as we close later on. Plague number 7, Exodus chapter 9. Let's go down to verse 22. Exodus chapter 9, verse 22. Then the Eternal said to Moses, "Stretch out your hand toward heaven, that there may be hail in all the land of Egypt, on man, on beast, on every herb of the field throughout the land of Egypt." Now you have to ask, how often does hail fall in Egypt? And the answer is almost never. It's a desert. Hardly any rain, let alone hail. Massive hail in this case. Verse 23. Moses stretched out his rod toward heaven, and the Lord sent thunder and hail, and fire darted to the ground. Now again, the way Cecil B. DeMille and others interpret this is that these burning balls of hail fall from the sky. And that may be what happened. Just as logically, though, as these large balls of hail drop to the ground. And when it says fire darted to the ground, we may be talking about massive lightning strikes. Not hail that burns itself, but these massive lightning strikes, this fire raining from heaven, along with these balls of ice that just destroy all the crops around. Verse 23, Moses stretched out his hand. This is what occurred. Verse 24, there was hail, and fire mingled with the hail, so very heavy that there was none like it in all the land of Egypt since it became a nation. No one could remember anything like this ever before. Verse 22, 25, and hail struck throughout the whole land of Egypt, all that was in the field, both man and beast. And the hail struck every herb of the field and broke every tree in the field. So we're talking about massive balls of ice, hail, dropping out of the sky. Only in the land of Goshen, where the children of Israel were, there was no hail. So who fell down in protecting Egypt in this case? Well, we mentioned earlier the goddess of the sky. Her name was Nut, or some pronounce it Nut, N-U-T. Since this plague originated from the sky, it would have been obvious that it was her job to protect the Egyptians from this disaster. Nut was represented as a dark-skinned woman, black or midnight blue, standing on all fours, whose fingers and toes touch the horizon. She's leaning over her husband Geb, who is the earth below. Her body's covered with skies, and she's arching up over the earth, over Geb and over the crops. So she would relax once at the end of the day at sunset. Literally, they thought, or their story was, well, she got hungry and she ate Amun as he came around, ate Ra as he came around, and then birthed him again the next morning, and he came up again. Okay, as I said, it's a little weird, but that's what they believed. So what is fascinating is that she should have been protecting them from the sky, but she could not. In one myth, she is the mother whose laughter was the thunder and whose tears were the rain. So she should have been protecting and watching over Israel, I should say over Egypt, but could not in the face of the God of Israel. There's another God who should have been on duty at this point. His name is Seth, S-E-T-H, Seth. Seth was the storm god, associated with strange and frightening events such as eclipses, thunderstorms, and earthquakes. He also represented the desert and, by extension, foreign lands beyond the desert. So he should have been protecting. Maybe he was just let loose here. A third god in this case was Shu, S-H-U. Shu was the Egyptian god of air. Shu is known as the god of atmosphere and wind, considered the god of space and light between the sky. As the god of cool air, he represented the space between heaven and earth and gave breath to all living creatures. Shu was a disappointment. He could not stand the God of Israel and prevent this terrible destruction from all this hail. So in verse 26, once again, only Goshen was spared. Verse 27, Pharaoh sent and called for Moses and Aaron, said, "Now I've sinned this time. The Lord is righteous, and my people and I are wicked." He can understand that for a moment. "Entreat Yahweh the Eternal that there may be no more mighty thundering and hail, for it's enough. I will let you go, and you will stay no longer." Moses said to him, "As soon as I have gone out of the city, I will spread out my hands to the Eternal. The thunder will cease. There'll be no more hail, that you may know that the earth is the Eternal's." It's not Geb's, it's not Put's, it's not anyone else's, it's not Seth's, it's not Shu's, it's no one's but the Eternal's. "But as for you and your servants, I know that you will not yet fear the Eternal God." Now the flax and barley were struck, for the barley was in the head and the flax was in the bud. So again, we're talking early springtime before the holy days. "The wheat and the spelt were not struck, for they are later crops. So Moses went out of the city from Pharaoh, spread out his hands to the Eternal. Then the thunder and hail ceased, and the rain poured not on the earth." So you see, Pharaoh said, "Well, we'll still get a harvest. It'll be not the barley harvest, but we'll still have wheat and spelt. We'll be okay." Pharaoh saw the rain, the hail, and thunder had ceased. He sinned yet more and hardened his heart, he and his servants. So the heart of Pharaoh was hard. Neither would he let the children of Israel go, as the Eternal had spoken by Moses. Setting the stage, of course, for plague number 10. Let's drop down in chapter 10. I'm sorry, plague number 8. Chapter 10 in verse 12. The Eternal said to Moses, "Stretch out your hand." Chapter 10, verse 12. "Stretch out your hand over the land of Egypt for the locusts, that they may come upon the land of Egypt and eat every herb of the land, all that the hail has left. So Moses stretched out his rod over the land of Egypt, not Aaron this time, Moses. And the Eternal brought an east wind on the land all that day and all that night. And when it was morning, the east wind brought the locusts. So far out of the deserts from the east, the locusts came upon Egypt. Verse 14. And the locusts went up over all the land of Egypt and rested on the territory of Egypt. And they were very severe. Previously, there had been no such locust as they, nor shall there be such after them. This was a special intervention by God. For they covered the face of the whole earth, so that the land was darkened. And they ate every herb of the land, and all the fruit of the trees, which the hail had left. So there remained nothing green on the trees or on the plants of the field throughout all the land of Egypt. They simply ate everything. What gods should have been on duty in Egypt preventing this plague? The first one is Neper, N-E-P-E-R. In ancient Egyptian religion, Neper, or Nepri, or Nepra, was the god of grain. Like, why weren't you protecting our grain? He had a female counterpart, Nepit, the goddess of grain. And when they're depicted on reliefs, they're dotted all over their body, like spotted, to depict these grains that are growing away. Where were you to protect our crops? A second god that should have been, a goddess, I should say, that should have been taking care of the Egyptians was Renenutet, R-E-N-E-N, Renenutet, U-T-E-T, R-E-N-E-N-U-T-E-T. Renenutet was the goddess of nourishment, the goddess of the harvest. She was usually pictured as a cobra or a woman with the head of a cobra. She should have been fighting for her people, protecting the harvest, but she was not able to do that. Thermuthis is also a god that should have been on duty, goddess, I should say. She guarded the king, and later she guarded the farmer's harvests. Again, she also has this cobra, so she may have been a later depiction of this same god, or goddess, I should say. So, Israel's God showed himself to be in control of every one of the Egyptian gods. Plague number 9, the darkness. Here in chapter 10, verse 21, thus, then the Eternal said to Moses, stretch out your hand toward heaven, that there may be darkness over the land of Egypt. Darkness which may even be felt. This intense darkness. Now, Egyptians did have an explanation for some events in the heavens. Like an eclipse, for example. That as Ra began his trek across the sky, he was actually in a boat. And he would go over Nut and slide along her back, basically, along the way. But there were enemies in the waters up there that would try to throw him off course. So he had protectors on his boat that would protect him along the way. But one of the particular gods that was a very nasty one was a serpent-like god up there. And every once in a while, this god would swallow Ra and his boat. And that would cause these terrible storms, or it would cause these blackouts of the sun. These very temporary little, what's a typical eclipse lasts just a few minutes. So the protectors on the boat would eventually fight out of the snake and they would have sun once again. So pretty interesting but ridiculous stories. But 3 days of darkness, unheard of. 3 days of darkness. If we continue on here in verse 23, they did not see. Well, maybe we go to verse 22. So Moses stretched out his hand toward heaven, and there was thick darkness in all the land of Egypt 3 days. They did not see one another, nor did anyone rise from his place for 3 days. But all the children of Israel had light in their dwellings. So this strange darkness, again, unlike anything. Well, obviously the God under attack at this point, by our God, was the god Ra, or Re. It's either spelled R-A or R-E, sometimes called Amun-Ra, as we said earlier. Ra was the primary name of the sun god of ancient Egypt. He's often considered to be the king of all gods. And so he was therefore the patron of Pharaoh, one of the central gods in the Egyptian pantheon. He's also described sometimes as the creator of everything. Ra is the king of the gods, the most important Egyptian god, called the god, sun god of Anu, or Heliopolis. He became the state deity in the 5th dynasty. Some traditions made him the creator of men. The Egyptians called themselves the cattle of Ra. Amun-Ra was the chief deity of Egypt and the sun god who was part of the very important triad, including his wife, the mother god. So Ra fell down. He was not able to stand against the true God. So this was not only an attack against the chief god of Egypt, but also against Pharaoh himself, because Pharaoh was often seen as the divine representation of the sun god. Pharaohs would shave their heads because it pictured the sun and the sun god. So they would have complete baldness there. How about the 10th plague? Last but not least, the death of the firstborn. Exodus chapter 11 and verse 1. The Eternal said to Moses, I will bring one more plague on Pharaoh and on Egypt. Afterward, he will let you go from here. And when he lets you go, he surely will drive you out of here altogether. Speak now in the hearing of the people. Let every man ask from his neighbor and every woman from her neighbor articles of silver and gold. And the Eternal gave the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians. Moreover, the man Moses was very great in the land of Egypt, in the sight of Pharaoh's servants, in the sight of all the people. Moses said, thus says the Eternal, about midnight I will go out in the midst of Egypt. And all the firstborn in the land of Egypt shall die, from the firstborn of Pharaoh who sits on his throne, even to the firstborn of the female servant who is behind the handmill, and all the firstborn of the animals. There shall be a great cry throughout all the land of Egypt, such as was not like it before, nor shall be like it again. Let's turn over to chapter 12, in verse 29, as it comes to pass. Chapter 12 and verse 29, and it came to pass at midnight that the Eternal struck all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, from the firstborn of Pharaoh who sat on his throne to the firstborn of the captive who was in the dungeon, and all the firstborn of livestock. So Pharaoh arose in the night, he and all his servants and all the Egyptians, and there was a great cry in Egypt, for there was not a house where there was not one dead. What gods should have been on duty protecting the Egyptians? Well, frankly, all of them. All of them. It certainly would have been humiliating to Meshkenet. She was the goddess who presided at a birth over a baby. Hathor, one of the 7 deities who was also supposed to be at every childbirth. Min, the goddess of procreation. Selket, the guardian of life. And we said Renenutet, the cobra goddess and guardian of Pharaoh himself. All of these gods should have been on duty, each one of them protecting the Egyptians from harm, from trouble, but none of them able to do so. God, our God, showed himself powerful over every single one of the Egyptian gods. He judged the Egyptian gods. Now we go through this. It's fascinating to study this. But we ask ourselves, what should we be learning from this? There is no power on earth that can stand against the true God. When you face trial and trouble and difficulty, remember the lesson of the plagues. There is nothing that can stand before the true God. Now we mentioned earlier as well, what modern gods might be represented by these ancient deities? Gods that people look to today, maybe unknowingly or unwittingly, for their sustenance and support. Can we make a list of modern gods that are bowed down to by many in our culture? And the answer is yes, we can. But that's the subject for a great holy day sermon. So we'll pick that up on Monday.